You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
All right, everybody, this is the Brian Callen Show, and I am Brian Callen with my partner in crime, Hunter Motz. Such a weird name, by the way. just really quickly, I will be at the Brea Improv tonight. That is July 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st, 22nd. Just the 21st, doing stand-up. So only come if you like to laugh really hard. And then I'll be at the Schaumburg Improv in Illinois, right near Chicago, July 25th, 26th, 27th, and 28th. So last time I did stand-up in Chicago, the Blackhawks came and kidnapped me and brought me to a bar, and I can't go into what happened. But none of that really matters, because my guest, James Rollins, whose book, The Eye of God, his books are basically international bestsellers, but his new book, The Eye of God, which is a hell of a book, just made the New York Times bestseller list. James Rollins, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing fantastic.
Good. Well, are you in Missouri right now? Where are you?
I am in Sacramento, California.
Okay. Well, it's funny, because your books span, you know, the globe. I know you've traveled to a lot of these places. Let's just start with the fact that the first thing I want to talk about is the fact that I was fascinated with doing research on you. You started you were a successful vegetarian. I mean, vegetarian and veterinarian. But you were a really successful veterinarian with your own practice. You had 15 employees, and you decide, because you listen to you. It's so funny, the admission where you went, you know what? I could tell you the fake story. I could tell you the real story. The reason I became a writer was because of Tony Robbins. He was literally watching like an infomercial. He sends away for the tapes, which, by the way, I did too, James. We'll get into Tony in a second, but because I wrote a TV show about a self help guru, and I wanted to make fun of him, so I listened to Tony Robbins thinking I was going to make fun of him, and literally like a tape in, I went, "This dude's a genius," and he basically said, "Write down what you want to be on a piece of paper." You did that. You only got through one CD, and the rest is history. You became
here in my office. I still have it's like a 12 CD set, right, all wrapped in cellophane. The only one that's still to this day, I still have it on my shelf. I'm looking at it right now in my office. The only one unwrapped is that very first set of tapes. You know?
That right there is an endorsement for Tony Robbins. All you needed was to get through one CD, and you became an international best-selling author.
I try to keep that secret, because I'm secretly fearful that Tony Robbins is going to, you know, there'll be a knock on my door.
Where's my cut?
And
where's
my cut? He'll be holding out his hand. You know,
He doesn't need any more money.
But James, here's a question for you. What do you think happens if you listen to all 12 tapes? I mean, if one tape takes you to like New York Times bestseller.
He becomes Faulkner.
Yeah, exactly.
Either that or Dan Brown. Not quite.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's actually. But here's my question. I mean, people are comparing you to Dan Brown, to Robert Ludlum, to
Michael Crichton.
Michael Crichton. And you know, you started out as this veterinarian. I know you were an avid reader, but that's got to be. I mean, that's got to be such a rush. I mean, honestly, when I'm on stage sometimes and I'm doing stand up for all these people and they're laughing, I don't remember writing it. And sometimes I literally in the middle of my show, I go, I can't believe I do this for a living. I can't believe I even know how to do this. I don't know how I know how to do this, but it's just such a privilege. Do you ever find yourself in that position where you just go, how the hell did I write this? All these books that seem to continue, like constantly work.
Yeah, when I wrote my first book, I had no expectation it was going to be a change in my career. My goal was just to walk into a bookstore and see my book on a shelf. Wow. I didn't care if they paid me. Of course, don't tell my publisher that.
Yeah.
I just, you know, that's all I wanted to have happen. And to have this, you know, one book sell, another book sell, and my clients at the veterinary hospital began to get suspicious. They were like, you know, Dr. Jim, what's your long-term plan? Of course, they had, you know, posters in the lobby, get your cat spayed, get a free book. Something was up.
That's awesome.
Listen, that's much better than the Bob Barker plan, right? Yeah, so, yeah. You know.
But when did you realize, I mean, you know, what's interesting is that you can say that, but at the end of the day, your books are real page turners. So you obviously have a talent that very few people have. There are a lot of people trying to write the way you do.
Oh, well, you know, I always wanted to be a veterinarian. I got that assignment you get in third grade. What do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah.
It was sort of a, the third grade version of myself was a point of moral dilemma. I had the blank sheet of paper in front of me, knew I wanted to fill it out as I want to be a veterinarian. Only problem, I didn't know how to spell veterinarian.
Nice.
So I did one thing all third graders hate to do. I looked it up. I was that determined from third grade to be a veterinarian.
Wow.
But the other side of my, you know, I was raised with three brothers and three sisters. We raised Polish Roman Catholic. To keep the Polish flag in your window, you had to have at least six kids, so my mom had a spare.
And by the way, your real name is Tchaikovsky.
Exactly.
Which would, you know, Jim Tchaikovsky isn't necessarily going to sell a lot of...
No, it won't.
Right.
But, my right. first conversation with my publisher was, we like your book, Jim, but your name's got to go.
Can't sell ah, that. Show business. Ah, Hollywood. Yeah.
And the funny thing is that you also have an entirely separate name for fantasy writing. Isn't that right?
Right. That's James Clemens.
Yeah.
Rollins' derivation is that the veterinary hospital, the veterinary University of Missouri's veterinary school is on Rollins Avenue. So.
There you go. It's like your porn star name.
Yeah. Exactly. You add things together. But when did you realize, you know, I mean, this is really a dream come true. I mean, you're a successful veterinarian. You decide all of a sudden you have to kind of quit your job because you're just too successful as a writer. I think you publish two books a year, which is insane.
I did, and I still pretty much do two books a year.
It's crazy.
And you know, my clients ask me the same question. You know, what was my long term goal with this writing? And I said, at this point, you know, for 15 years or so, veterinary medicine was my paycheck, and writing was just a hobby. And I thought, you know, it'd be really cool to sort of flip that on its ear and have, you know, veterinary medicine be my hobby and writing just be my paycheck. And it's sort of nice.
I can just hear a bunch of aspiring writers go, just going, fuck this guy. did you decide that? Did you decide? It's like me saying, yeah, I decided to just, you know, I just decided to forget all this. I'm just going to become a musician now. I think I want to be a rock star. I mean, you've got a huge following. I mean, but when did you... Wasn't it a surprise to you when you were able to come up with these characters and come up with a pace for a book that was such a page turner? I mean, were you aware you could do that, though? When did you realize you could do that?
Well, I was always sort of a storyteller growing up. You know, my first victims for my storytelling were those brothers and sisters of mine. You know, the more tears involved in that storytelling, the better.
I called it sicko
storytelling. My mom called it lying.
That's that Catholic sensibility, right? Yeah. Any deviation from the absolute truth is lying, right?
Damn right.
Exactly. So then I read a lot also growing up, and that's, you know, like throwing gasoline on that little twisted corner of my head. And, you know, when I first started writing, I wrote just short stories. That's all I thought I could fit within the busy schedule of a veterinarian. I thought there's no way I can write a novel while I'm working 14, 16, 18 hours a day, 7 days out of the week. It just seemed all I can manage to squeeze into those little cracks would be a short story. But then, I decided to tackle my first novel and was lucky enough to see that first novel sell. But what I actually did was my first book was Subterranean, which I'll give you a quick plot synopsis. You know, take five characters, drop them 2 miles underneath the earth, throw in some monsters, and shake. That was my detailed outline before.
That's your detailed outline.
Exactly. Like, who's going down that hole? And what are they going to find? What type of monsters are down there?
Well,
what I used, actually, I had a copy of Jurassic Park, Michael Crichton's novel. I had that on my bookshelf right above my desk, and I just used that as a pattern. I thought, well, when does Michael Crichton introduce you? When does the first character die in Jurassic Park? When do you first see a dinosaur?
Hmm.
So I sort of patterned, you know, I rather than reinventing the wheel, I thought, well, here's a wonderful wheel already invented by Mr. Crichton. I'll just borrow his sort of roadmap.
Blueprint, yeah.
And follow from that. And that's the way I constructed my first novel.
Well, is there a writer, is there a writer out there that just kind of awes you? That just kind of, where you read them and you go, you know, yeah, because I remember the first time I read Faulkner when I was in college and I was trying to write and I just said, well, I'm not writing because this guy's, you know, he's the Michael Jordan of, you know, I mean, is there anybody that kind of blows your mind?
I mean, there's many different authors I'm just in awe of. Probably the one I pitch the most is someone that nobody knows seems to know that much about. A guy named Dan Simmons. He wrote wonderful novels. No matter what genre, what I like about him, he writes multiple genres. He writes similar to myself. I like to dabble a little bit in fantasy, a little bit in science fiction, a little bit in thrillers. He did the same thing, but unfortunately, he wins awards for every single genre. He writes a science fiction novel, he gets the Hugo Award. He writes a mystery novel, he gets the Edgar Award.
Wow, that's
spectacular,
amazing.
Multi-talented writer, and I'm just in awe of him. And I always plug him at Book Signs because that question always comes up. You know, who do you read? And So I'm going to be hunting Dan Simmons down and be knocking on his door with my hand held out going, you know, I think you owe me some royalties, Mr. Simmons.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think one of the things that's so fascinating about your stuff, you know, you, especially in the eye of God, is just your ability to handle so many different, you know, ideas from different realms. There's history, there's archaeology, there's exotic locations, you know, there's weird animals we've never heard of, you know, and then there's all of this incredible action, you know, the special forces stuff going on.
Not to mention the fact that a lot of his heroes are really human.
Mm-hmm.
They're connected to family. They're connected to, like, you. I think one of the things that makes your characters work so well is that you create a very sort of domestic human side to these stone cold killers or scientists or whatever. They have the same problems and the same fears and the same wants as all of us do. They just happen to be badasses with a gun, you know?
Well, I mean, if I'm going to make you care about a character I put in jeopardy through some type of a roller coaster of a plot, if I'm going to dangle a character over the cliff, you know, it's not going to be very thrilling unless you care whether that character falls or not.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal is to try to make characters that we can relate to. You know, I like the fact that my characters are juggling, you know, family life and professional life, because we all do that. So when a reader is reading one of my books and says, you know, I can relate to that, that immediately sort of sets up a bond between the reader and that character. So then again, when I dangle Gray over that cliff, you're going to care whether or not he falls, because you can relate to him.
Yeah, people depend on him.
Well, and I mean, that's one of the things that I thought was really interesting in reading some of your other interviews was, you know, you were talking about specifically he deals with his parents having Alzheimer's.
Right. And again, no author, I think, draws out of thin air for your characters. You know, I had the same issue. Both my parents developed Alzheimer's almost within the same time, so it was juggling two parents who were delusional in various states, and the one, you know, just so I was relating to that same thing while trying to get these books pumped out, two books.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that struggle was something I just sort of folded into the story because I could relate to that.
How many hours a day do you write?
Generally, I write 5 pages a day, 5 double spaces pages a day. It takes about an hour to write a page. So I do generally 5 pages of new writing, and then the rest of the day is usually research, you know, Facebook, business side of things.
Well, you know, speaking of research, one of the things that caught my eye was that in researching this book, you spoke to some mathematicians, and the latest sort of, theory is that this world that we are living in is a three-dimensional hologram.
Right, that just sort of blew my mind. I was invited to do a visit Fermilab, which is a national particle accelerator lab outside of Chicago. Great tour. During lunchtime, I'm sitting down, me on one side, a bunch of physicists on the other side of the table, and I posed a question to them that I often ask scientists whenever I get a chance to, is tell me something about your research that, you know, keeps you up at night, that frightens you.
Good question.
Exactly. It's a foundation for many of my novels.
Yeah.
And this is one of the theories that was proposed at that table was, and this is out in the news. You can actually find articles about this today, but at the time, back about 2 years ago when I was having this discussion, this is brand new. I never heard this concept that possibly everything that's real is not. This gentleman said, you know, everything that looks solid is not. It's really just lights and shadows. It's a game. It's possibly just a big hologram. And I'm thinking, well, you know, as an investigative novelist, I better, you know, in depth interview this fella. And I said, really? That was about the extent of my questioning.
Really?
Elaborate on it. And, you know, he said, can you make it simpler? And he tried to. He said, can you make it even simpler than that? And then he said, well, let me give you an example. And this is an example from a physicist named Brian Greene. He says, you know, this is something that if you take all of the empty space that's within atoms, you know, atoms have a hard little nucleus with electrons circulating. If you collapse all those electrons down to the nucleus, get all that dead air out of those atoms, took all that out, that every human being that ever existed on this planet from past to present, if you shrunk them all down, we'd all fit into the size of a baseball.
God damn it. God damn it. What the fuck is going on this podcast? And that's the kind of stuff that it just makes me start swearing out loud. I don't even know what to say about that shit. Jesus. All right, keep going.
So yeah, so at that point, that's how little of reality is real. Everything else, it's just empty space. It's void, it's shadow, it's energy. And that's really what the universe is. It's just that. It's light, shadows, and energy. Everything else that matters is a very, very small component of the universe. And so theoretically, yes, everything that we're seeing is may just be a big light show, even possibly constructed by somebody as some type of gigantic experiment out there.
Well, you use Plato's allegory of the cave, which I thought was awesome, to sort of describe what Plato said, you know, what was it, 3,000 years ago, you know, or Socrates really saying
right,
that,
I mean,
you know, we're basically, we're living in a cave and whatever we think is real is actually projected onto the side of this cave.
Which I just love, where history, you know, sort of intersects with the present. Here, you know, Plato mm-hmm. is telling us pretty much what the physicist was telling me at that lunch table.
Yeah.
Is that nothing is real, everything is just lights and shadows. You know, Plato already understood that back, you know, in ancient Greek times compared to this modern physicist across the table from me.
Well, you know, one of the things that I find amazing is that if a lot of mathematicians, you know, a mathematician will come out of a room after a lifetime of contemplation. He says, I've come up with a theorem. It has no particular relevance to everyday life. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to die now. And then 175 years later, some scientist at NASA or whatever, whether they're looking at the inside of a conch shell and how it relates to a beehive, they go, you know what? This theorem actually has physical relevance to the world we're living in, and here's how. And yet that came to some guy, some mathematician in a dream 175 years ago. That kind of stuff really makes me think that there's got to be an overall plan to this chaos that we're living in. There's got to be some kind of a direction. We're being nudged in some particular, or maybe hurled in some particular direction for a particular purpose. It's certainly what your books suggest.
Oh, yeah. I did an entire novel. It was, which one was it? can't remember my own books. Black Order, which deals with a theory called quantum evolution, that, you know, there's that old theory that nothing is real until you observe it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And there's some theory that we're being drawn forward, evolution is being drawn forward by some great observer, you know, way down in the future that is observing all these facts and drawing us towards a conclusion. You know, whether you want to call that figure that's up there God, whether you want to call that figure, you know, some type of ancient scientist. But there's a fascinating, you know, theory about quantum evolution raised in the book Black Order.
Well, what about, you talk about, you know, I've read Ray Kurzweil's The Singularity is Near, and the Kurzweilists talk about the fact that when you can download human memory and our thoughts onto a computer, when the physical body dies, your essence, your memories, who you are still exists somewhere, and then you can put it into a robot, and at the end of the day, we're not going to die. And so there are different theories on what exactly, or we will mesh with machines eventually, and that's already happening with nanotechnology. And
it happens in the Eye of God too.
Right, exactly. You know? So there's a third, explain to us the third level of immortality where people right now may very well be walking around with this technology.
Well, exactly. I mean, there's a couple different theories. Number one is that they believe that the seat of human consciousness is still a mystery to scientists. We don't know where the seat of human consciousness lies. We know it's somewhere generated by the brain, but we don't know exactly how, where, and, you know, can we point to say, here's consciousness right here. We can't do that today.
Mm.
The newest theory is that, you know, the brain functions almost like a quantum computer is the theory.
Explain quantum for some of the listeners.
Sure, it's very simple. At least all the quantum, but I'll explain what quantum computer is. You know, basically computers, everybody knows, is made out of zeros and ones.
Mm, right.
The binary system. Quantum computers basically is a computer that's built upon zeros, ones, and also a third component called zero and one, or zero and not one.
Jeez, whatever. Back to being fit into a baseball. Hunter's got his hands down his pants. He doesn't even know what to do anymore. Jesus, Mont.
Well, apparently, if I have my hands down my pants, I do know what to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, exactly. Obviously. But keep going. He gets turned on by these binary numbers.
So being binary, the computer's basically like a trinary, or, you know, it's delved off into a whole another dimension.
Right.
And that's the way to believe that the brain may be functioning, how this, you know, this little, you know, couple pounds of gray matter is able to function as such a complex and amazing computer. It's just functioning on the quantum level. And that's where where some scientists believe that consciousness lies. It's not actually in our brain. It's in this quantum field generated by this quantum computer that is our brain. And so it's not even really in our head. It's sort of out there in this field out there. And that one of the theories of that after you die, that consciousness in this quantum field still exists, and potentially it can go somewhere else. Now, religion says that somewhere else might be heaven, might be hell. scientists say, well, maybe we cross into another dimension and we continue in some other form. In this book, I posited another theory from talking to religious scholars and talking to these physicists. I have my own theory about where that consciousness may go, and it's critical to the end of the novel, so I'm a little reluctant.
Don't give away exactly. You got to read the novel because it's such a page turner and so fun. So that I'm glad you said that because I was like, wait a minute, we don't want to give away the ending here. But you know, as you have access to these scientists, you use your imagination, Jim. You constantly are writing. Do you have what is your and you study a lot of ancient history? I mean, a lot of these stories, the Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan and a lot of the stories that you reference are actually they're historically valid. So if you look at the human history, do you have a point of view on where we're headed? Do you have a point of view on why we're headed there? Do you have a point of view on how different, whether we're less brutal, whether we really are evolving as a species versus when Attila the Hun was ruling the world?
I think we are evolving. You know, I'm possibly a bit of an optimist in that respect. I think that, you know, we're basically going through a fire that's forging us. Something stronger. And we're going to have setbacks where there's a period of time like the Dark Ages where we seem to be like going forward and also, nope, we're taking four steps back now. But I believe ultimately we're heading forward. At least that's my own theory. I'm maybe a little bit of an optimist to think that. But, you know, I think at this point, just comparing the past to the present.
Were you raised religious?
I was raised Polish Roman Catholic, I said.
Yeah, right. What is your exposure to all the science done to your religious faith?
You know, one of the theories or one of the themes across my novels, I try to balance religion and science. Usually the two camps that are considered to be diametrically opposed, there's no common ground, there's a line drawn in the sand. One of my goals is to look for that gray area between there. Where does science and religion, you know, possibly merge? That's the playground I like to play in. Personally, myself, I'm not a practicing Roman Catholic anymore. I have a tendency to set all my own beliefs about you know, the golden rule and you know, just living the best life you can and leaving the world better from being here. That's my sort of faith with science.
Well, one of the things that, you know, if you read Socrates, for example, in the dialogues, one of the things that he says is that the question is raised, can virtue be taught? And he goes through this sort of notion that, in fact, it can't be taught. You have to just remember it. Wisdom comes from the practice of knowledge, studying knowledge, and then you will gain wisdom. And there are certain truths that essentially have always existed, and the definition of a truth being that it never changes. It does not rely on the perceiver. It doesn't need to be perceived. For example, the way you compute a right triangle, a squared times b squared equals c squared, the way you measure a right triangle is a truism that exists regardless of whether the universe is here or not. At least the universe as we know it is not. And then as you do more research and you look at what social scientists are finding is that children are born across, you know, well, if you take a look at, you cross-reference all cultures throughout time, there are essentially, there seems to be a human blueprint that we're born with. There seems to be an inherent, innate, at least tendencies toward things like care, tribal. The human beings are very tribal. We band together over things. There is this nostalgia for some kind of sanctity, for reverence of something we can't necessarily explain or measure. There is a reverence for authority. Authority seems to sort of be a natural order between human beings. So we are born. I mean, it seems that science is suggesting the more we know. In this exponential age, it seems to me that we are learning that there are certain things human beings are born with, and it's not instinct. Rather, it's some kind of inherent knowledge. I don't know if you've done any of that research, but
I also think one thing that's missing in that equation of yours is the fact that, you know, I think one fundamental aspect of human beings, you know, we're given this big brain that's always questioning, that's always looking, that's always seeking. And that's something I think that is a fundamental part of who we are. I think that's the reason why I'm a little optimistic in the fact that we can potentially be moving forward to something greater, is that we are always seeking. We're trying to find, trying to fill in those gaps. Now, some people will put God in those gaps. Scientists might look for some explanation between those gaps. But one thing about the human species is we're always questing. You know,
right.
Always looking. We're all searching for that answer. And that's probably, and this is very distinct from us from animals, is that you know, me as a veterinarian, I have great respect for animals, but I think one distinct difference between us and them is that we do have that ability to be constantly questioning and seeking.
Well, we have potential, don't we? I mean, it seems like dogs and animals, a wolf has always been a wolf, but human beings have potential to
adapt
essentially
to any
go beyond their biology, go beyond their own sort of mental constructs, et cetera, right? I mean, that's kind of fundamental difference.
I think the other thing is that's interesting is, you know, and I know that, for example, readers have pointed out to you that you use a lot of animals in your novels. The other thing that I think is interesting in terms of your experience as a vet is the degree to which there seems to be a lot of nonverbal communication in your novels. There's a lot of people just sort of really getting each other without having to really say anything.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, to what extent, because it's always interesting the relationship that people have with the animals in their lives, because we have a lot of the same emotional systems, and so you can tell how your dog or your cat or whatever animal is feeling. And in the same way that, you know, even if you don't speak the same language as another person, you can still experience that same connection through facial expressions and all that sort of stuff. Is that something you're conscious of? Is that something that, you know, even in your work as a vet, you recognize your ability to diagnose what's going on with the animal through, you know, their body language, through their emotions? Do you know what I mean?
Right. I mean, I definitely did a lot of study about the human-animal bond, a lot of research about that connection, the fact that, you know, if you pet a cat, your blood pressure goes down. It's not even necessarily even just a physical reading of expression. There is something going on there. There's some connection between humans and animals. There's some need for that, I believe. And I did a USO tour to Iraq and Kuwait back about a year and a half ago, and I got to see some of the military handlers and their war dogs working out there. And I thought, well, these might make an intriguing character. I actually populated my previous novel, Bloodline, with a team like that. And that allowed me to even get into more depth about this relationship, this working relationship between a dog and a handler. And speaking to a lot of these gentlemen, I was asking, you know, what's their relationship like? And I kept hearing this phrase is it runs down the lead. And what this meant is that over time, the emotion between the handler and the dog, they become so intimate that they can almost read each other without needing to gesture or speak, that the emotions run up and down that leash between them.
Running down the lead.
It runs down the
lead. I know in one of your books you wrote about a war dog, and you wrote from the war dog's perspective.
Right. Because, again, I wanted to try to not do a Disney version of the war dog.
Yeah.
Oh, pal.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, there's a bomb.
I wanted to make it a real dog. I wanted to, you know, how does a dog experience the world? You know, we'll give one brief example of that. You know, all my scenes that I wrote from the dog's perspective, I switched from past tense from the rest of the novel to present tense for the dog. Because the dogs live in the moment. They're creatures. They don't have a whole lot of concept of past and future. They just live now. So I switched to present tense because that's the way the dog would experience it. So I try to take my veterinary knowledge, take my, you know, my understanding of the human-animal bond, and sort of fold that into those scenes where I was writing from the dog's POV.
You know, I'm kind of laughing to myself because I did a USO tour as well, and the difference between you and I is that I went and saw the war dogs, and I put on a bite suit with my buddy Dove Davidoff, and I let the dogs cut. They sick the dogs. I mean, these Belgian Malinois. And I just wanted to see what it was like to get attacked by a dog like that, and even through the suit, I was like, this hurts a lot. Get your wolf off me immediately. And that was my experience with the USO and dogs. You know, and Jim is like basically getting into this. You're doing research and actually asking what it's about. So there's the difference between my guest and me, ladies and gentlemen, right there.
I've been bitten by enough dogs in my veterinary practice that I didn't have to experience that.
Yeah, I've always wondered that with you guys. You do crazy stuff. I mean, I have a pit bull who's got to have her ear part of her ear removed for this cancerous like tumor. But and my dog's a sweetheart, but she's a big animal, and I don't know. I mean, how many dogs have you bitten?
Oh, actually, not. It's more cat bites.
Oh, really?
Dogs. Yeah, cats. I mean, I'll take a mean, vicious dog versus a a frightened cat.
Wow.
And
jeez.
Because, you know, they got those claws and they move fast and you know, cat bites just do horrible things if you get bitten by cats.
Really? Dirty mouths, man. Now, bring us into one of the characters you got in this book has got a magnetic fingertips, and you say that actually exists.
It does. You know, I encountered them oddly enough at a body modification fair that was in San Francisco. Of course, that's where you'd expect to see a body modification.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm always looking for that. I want my antenna up for that. You know, piece of history that ended a question mark or that piece of science that makes you go, what if? But I'm also looking for that character. You know, that's something that's out of the norm. And so I thought this might be a great place to experience that.
Wow.
And so I saw this gentleman getting his fingertips operated on, and the operator, by the way, was a dental hygienist.
Nice.
Not exactly, you know, above board. But I was fascinated. So, you know, what's going on here? And he explained to me that they're inserting these rice-sized pieces of rare earth magnet right next to the nerve endings in his fingertips. And I thought, well, what is he doing? Is he planning to be like Spider-Man? Is he planning to, like, stick to the side of his refrigerator? And he says, no, it's too weak for that. You know, he won't even set off a TSA sensors. The magnets are so small and so weak. But what they do is these magnets vibrate in the presence of an electrical field and stimulate that nerve to send a feeling. And he says it almost opens up a third sense. I said, what do you mean by sixth sense? What do you mean by that? And he goes, well, you know, it's hard to describe. You know, every electrical field is different, so it vibrates the magnet differently, and I can sense different textures and rhythms and volumes and even heat to different types of electrical fields. He says, even I can tell different colors between electrical fields. And I said, what do you mean by colors? He says, well, it's hard to describe because it's almost like describing the color blue to a blind person who's never seen the color blue before. You almost have to just experience it.
Wow, that's so crazy.
So I'm thinking, what's the practical use for this? You know, me, I'm just thinking it's got to be, you know, that's cool, but is there any practice? So, well, actually, I'm an electrical engineer, and I can use this sensation to tell when a hard drive in a laptop's malfunctioning without actually having to open the laptop.
Wow.
Whoa.
So it's very useful for me to know how energy is flowing through wires and how circuits are operating. He says he's a friend of his is a garage mechanic, and he says it helps him actually, you know, fix carburetors. Can you tell when the spark plug is misfiring? Again, just by sensing it through his fingertips. So again, I thought that's just fascinating. You know, nobody really knows about this new technology, and it's there's about 1,000 people, according to this gentleman, that have these magnetic fingertips. Out there, so it's just fascinating. So I wanted to again fold that character into my story.
Well, and it's so, I mean, it plays such a central role in the Eye of God. I mean, you use it so well, you know.
I know.
It's great. It's
well, that's
great.
that's where your gift comes in. Your ability to kind of, I mean, there are a lot of moving parts in a book like this, and somehow you create this web that's just a complete page turner, man. And by the way, everybody, the book again is The Eye of God. And we're going to have that up on our website, and just go to the website and click on the Amazon banner, and you'll get it. And by the way, it's out on audio too, right?
Audio, e-books.
Who's the actor that reads it?
Oh, I can't remember. I just saw his name just yesterday, and
yeah. It's good though, huh?
It's good. Yep.
Because it seems like your books should be listened to just as much as read. I don't know.
I mean, I still like to listen to audiobooks whenever I'm on a long trip.
Me too.
It's, you know, you get tired of hearing the same song over and over again on the radio.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what about, have your books, why haven't any of your books been made into a movie?
They've all been optioned.
Okay.
Hollywood, you know, has optioned every single one of my novels.
Jeez, must be nice. Jeez, whatever, dude.
What's your money pit like? Because mine's empty.
I was going to say, yeah. Hey, Jace, can you drive a car off a cliff into your money pit? We'd like to take a ride.
All right. Actually, a lot of times there's not that much money involved in these options. They basically rent your book. They rent your book for a while to see if they can attach talent. And the whole Sigma Force series has been optioned by Dino De Laurentiis' production company. And I got to meet Dino back a couple of years ago before he died. 90 years old, met him at his house in Bel Air.
Wow. How was that house?
It was actually very cool. It was sort of old Hollywood. Dino was great. He was charming. You know, he was a 90-year-old guy. He's like clambering up his library ladders, pulling books off his library shelf and throwing them at me. You must read this, Jim.
Wow.
So this is an Italian. I'll learn Italian and I'll read this right away.
Right.
But didn't Dino actually read your book in Italian?
He did. He was on vacation in Italy and he read the book in Italian and liked it and came back and said, you know, I want to do this project. So,
well, by the way, you know you're kicking ass as an author when your books are translated into 40 different languages or whatever it is. I mean,
that's pretty odd. I mean, that's also a little bit freaky. It's hard for me to have that concept that something I'm writing here in my little office is going to be read by somebody in China.
Yeah, you get fan mail from all over the world.
Oh, definitely. Sometimes they send me in their native language, which does not help me too much.
But there's always Google Translate.
That's right. Yes, and the Google Translate is something that's quite amusing. I'm sure that's not what they actually told me.
Where do you see, you've got your finger pulse on technology. Where do you see, what are we going to be doing in 10 years? What are computers going to look like? Well, what do you think?
I think we're going to see the merging of biology and technology.
In 10 years?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was my last book, Bloodline, dealt specifically with that concept, based upon a Time magazine article, which I saw when I was in line at the grocery store. And, here is the cover. It says, 2045, the year man becomes immortal. So I think we're going to see more and more of that happening. We're already talking about the iPod watch that's going to occur. We're talking about, Eye of God, this character has an RFID chip implanted to help him unlock all of his password-protected devices and unlock his car. And I thought, well, that was pretty cutting edge, but even now that's passe. Now they have electronic tattoos, where people are getting these tattoos done that actually have the same thing. They have the technology in the tattoo.
Every time I hear about this, I think of Revelations and the Mark of the Beast. I mean, it really does make you kind of think. That's exactly what John the Baptist, I think it was, said, basically, that we're going to have numbers tattooed to our, and it'll be our currency. I'm not religious, but gee whiz, man. You have to
like that, doesn't it?
You know what I mean? It's a little bit like...
Look at Google Glass and all these other technologies. They seem to be wanting to merge this biology and technology together. So I think over the next 10 years, we're going to see that becoming more and more. And just look at the technology level today. I mean, compare 10 years ago, the power of a personal laptop and how things have shrunken and increased in power. Extrapolate that 10 years from now, it's almost going to be a different world 10 years from now.
Do you see any dangers to that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's always dangers for corruption, for manipulation. I mean, look what's going on with the NSA couldn't do what they're doing today in regards to monitoring, except for the fact that we have computing power that can digest that much information.
Well, what do you think about that, James? You're obviously a patriot, and you got to do the USO tour and all that. But I really worry about, I was just in London, and something like the average Londoner, if you're in London, you get photographed something like 255 times an hour or something crazy. I can't remember what the statistic was. We're getting to that point in this country. The NSA does collect information on American citizens, and fairly from what I understand a lot more extensively than we've been led to believe. Don't you see some hidden dangers in that? How do you feel about that? I mean, you write about this stuff.
Totally. I mean, I believe that we are giving away freedoms for the sake of security. And I think if we allow that to go unchecked and uncommented, that it will get more and more abused.
What do we do about it?
I think that, again, awareness is the biggest thing, is to know and find ways around that. Knowledge is our greatest power.
What do you think of the Snowden issue? I mean, the guy basically said, hey, guess what? The NSA is collecting data on American citizens. I think that's the extent. I mean, I don't know, but boy, oh boy.
Well, I think that should have been whistleblowed.
Me too.
I don't think his tactic was correct. I'm not quite sure why fleeing to Russia, which is,
right.
A country where you're worried about a country that's, overly monitoring you.
Right.
And you go to Russia, seems an odd choice. So there's something, to me, I think there's some untold part of that story still that's left.
Like he could have been a Russian agent or
there's
something.
There's something else going on. There's more than's being told yet.
I smell another book?
Sequel, yeah.
we all watch Snowden. Rollins is going, you know what? I'm writing a book, baby. Here comes another bestseller.
There's something else going on there. But in regards to whistleblowing, yes, I think this is something that should have been out. I think we should have knowledge of that. Then it's for then us to draw a line. How much monitoring is okay, and where is the line we say this is where you can't cross?
Right.
If that line is never drawn, they're going to keep crossing it.
Well, that's the history, isn't that? That's what the founding fathers were so worried about and always warned us about. I mean, the bottom line is, I think it was George Washington or maybe Ben Franklin who said, "Men will invent laws to take their own freedom away from themselves."
Right.
Right? I mean,
exactly.
These are things that we have to keep, we have to keep shouting about. I really worry that as citizens, the powers that be become this amorphous collection of quote-unquote agencies, and who do you strike back at? I mean, my friend has a business, a very successful one. The IRS comes in. They audit him, and they've been auditing him for 2 years now. It cost him over $1 million to deal with these guys, just, you know, to provide the information they want. And then they go, see you later. Thanks. Didn't find anything. Bye. And that's $1 million out of your pocket,
yep.
You know? It really makes me... as I get older, I become way more cynical about the fact that it seems to me that anybody in power is going to exercise that power. It's a human compulsion. It doesn't mean that people at the IRS are bad people or politicians are all bad people. It just means that when you have a system and incentive structure in place, it's going to be abused.
Well, it goes back to what James Madison said, right? Which is that, you know, you have governments because people can't be trusted. But the problem is you have to people governments with people who can't be trusted, right? And so the only solution is to set ambition against ambition. You just have, you know, the people compete with the government competes with itself.
Special interests compete with special interests.
That's right. Yeah. But it's only, and that's the thing, but I think the special interest is an interesting one, and you and I have talked about this, which is that, you know, the special interests are all competing for control of the government. But the problem is that what happens when special interests compete is not necessarily what's right for the country. Right. And so I think that's the thing is, you know, the reason why the Constitution was, you know, agonized over and crafted so delicately is because it's like a game of football or a game of basketball. You need to get the rules exactly right so that the competition is maximized,
right,
and it's constructive competition.
Well, James, you write about threats. I mean, the you're always seeing threats out there. It's the fodder for your books.
Yep.
I'm sure you think about
everything
this
we just talked about is is pretty much what I'm working on right now.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's a major component of the book I'm writing right now.
Oh, wow.
You know, specifically with that, which is this incremental, you know, creep of security for the sake of freedom. I mean, giving up freedom for the sake of security.
And is it another Sigma Force novel? Because, I mean, that's...
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing, guys. I would really say, like, I've read a bunch of the Sigma Force novels, which is Eye of God is part of that series.
Yeah.
And the series is so great. You know,
yeah,
you weave the characters in, you know, I mean, it's just so much fun. And I mean,
you can't read the book and not keep reading. I'll say that. That's a fact.
And it's such a fun way to learn about things. You know what I mean? Because the writing is so engaging.
Yeah. And,
like,
and a lot of it's historically, yeah. You know, I've always said, if you want to learn about history, read it in a novel. I mean, that's what Leon Uris was so good at.
Yeah. My goal when I write is, you know, to have, you know, book in the hand, toes in the sand, type of beach read. You know, I want you turning pages late in the night, but, you know, the greatest compliments I ever get from somebody is saying that, you know, I turned that last page, I closed the book, and, you know, I was really interested in that aspect of the book or that piece of science, that piece of history, and so I did my own investigation into that afterwards. And at the end of all my novels, I have sort of a what's true and what's not fiction, where I sort of separate fact from fiction. So I leave some breadcrumbs for hopefully anybody that has some interest in certain aspects of the books, they can follow on their own.
Well, you know, let me just, in the end of the book, you have The Eye of God, which is the title of the book, and you kind of explain, and I'll read it, you say, the Eye of God, it's real, or rather, they are real. Scientists have created four flawless spheres of fused quartz, each so perfect that any defects are no larger than 40 atoms. They are the gyroscopic hearts of NASA's Gravity Probe B satellite, where they will be testing the curvature of space-time around the Earth. Hunter, take your hands out of your pants. I'm not done. And hopefully not to explore Comet Ison, I-S-O-N, which is, you know, in the book, because we all now know that's not a very good idea. Please explain, and I know you touch on this a lot in the book, but please explain what you mean by the Eye of God, and in James Rollins' layman terms here, what is curvature of space-time around the Earth? I mean, we've all read some Einstein, but Jesus.
We've all read some Einstein.
Einstein said that any mass curves space around it. He proved that by showing that you can actually see a star that's on the far side of the sun. Even though it's on the far side of the sun, because the space is curved, you can actually see it. So there definitely mass curves space and time. Eye of God itself refers to these satellites that are exploring this comet, and it's also so thematic that it's, you know, the Eye of God is, you know, where are we heading and what happens after we die. Sort of all these bigger themes tied to that title. But even Comet itself, you know, I always like to try to make but ground my stories in the real world. And the Comet Ison, you know, that's coming this November. It's a real comet. It's going to be passing by Earth in the middle of November. It's going to be the brightest celestial object in millennia. It's going to outshine the moon. It's going to be seen during the daytime. You're going to be able to still see the blaze of this comet.
When is that, 2014?
No, November.
November?
Yeah, this coming November. So it's always been harbingers of doom. Comets have been in the past. And so I thought, you know, hey, reading about this comet coming in November, I thought, well, I'm going to make that a harbinger of doom.
Wow. That's really wow. So we'll be able to see the comet.
Yep.
Depending on where we are on the Earth?
Yeah, it's northern, most of the northern hemisphere. So we're going to, here in the U.S., we're going to have a spectacular view of this comet.
And we don't know if it's coming at night or during the day.
It'll be here for like almost 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah, you'll be able to see it for about 2 weeks. It'll be in
But why is that? Is that because we'll see it streaking across the, you know, burning across the sky, essentially?
Right, so as it's heading towards its little lap around the sun, you know, it's fairly slow progress. So you're going to see it for about 2 weeks, you know, 1 week going in, 1 week going out. So you'll be able to see that comet for a while.
It's so insane. And these flawless spheres of fused quartz, are those lenses?
Yes, they're actually gyroscopes. They're going to spin these out in space, and you know, if you spin a gyroscope, it creates a little force, and they're going to use that force to be able to judge how the space is curved around the Earth.
No, I don't know any of that. I just write. I just write book. I mean, I just write jokes, and I can
say that, but I don't quite understand the math behind it. But supposedly, that's
God. I mean, somebody one time the other day said, God, you're smart. I was like, no, I'm not. I'm the farthest thing from smart in the world. I tell you, go to NASA and you'll find some smart people. And you've spent a lot of time with these people.
I do. I enjoy talking to these folks, and I can't say that I completely understand everything they try to talk to me, but what I love about the science is I try to make the science accessible in my books. I try to, like, you know, people think, well, quantum field, there's no quantum theory. I can't possibly understand that. But you can. And one guy told me once, you know, I could never understood quantum physics until I read your book.
Right.
So that's
wow.
Cool.
That's high praise.
Yeah, it is.
So it's pretty cool that I can take these sort of esoteric pieces of science and show them in how they have a practical aspect to them, how you can understand them, how they're not inaccessible. And so hopefully bring some of the wonder of what's going on in these fringes of science and bring them home so people can understand what's really going on there.
Well, I would suggest that you know a lot. You have a lot more in common than you think, in the sense that so much of mathematical theory and the great scientists, they use their imagination. I mean, it's about imagination, isn't it? I mean,
oh, definitely.
Yeah, and so this is exactly what you do with your books. I mean, you've obviously got a great imagination, and it seems to me that scientists that move the world had great imaginations.
Well, I think it's where everything starts. Everything starts with, you know, that what if. And I think that's, you know, that's how I start my books. I think that's how a lot of scientists, when they approach their science, I think that's when even with historians, you know, they're asking, you know, what if, you know, Attila's, the Hun's grave is finally found, or Genghis Khan's tomb is finally uncovered. There's, you know, it's a big, I mentioned before about our brains being this big questioning type of structure that, I think that's where everything begins.
But you know, have you done any research on what imagination is? I mean, that's another question. You know, we talk about the singularity where computers are going to start to essentially become very much like the human brain and go beyond. They'll be able to think. But that would mean that we'd have to isolate and define what they'd need imagination.
Right.
They'd be able to create something out of nothing, which I can understand that might be cross patterns and putting things together that didn't exist before, kind of like cross-pollinating different constructs, mental constructs, emotional constructs. Yes, but I don't know, man. I don't know if you could really put your finger on what imagination is.
Well,
could you?
I think you just did. It's when ideas have sex. And that's if you look at what, you know, James is talking about, right? You know, he said when he did Subterranean, he didn't need to reinvent the wheel, right? He took the basic pattern of Jurassic Park and he put it in a different setting with monsters and shook it up.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how you get a great novel like Subterranean. And, you know, in general, that's what makes your writing so satisfying, I think, is that you are able to draw together so many threads and put them together in this way that we've never seen before.
I think, you know, cross-pollination, that's the biggest key for imagination is just thinking outside the box, so to speak, is just taking, you know, one concept and mixing it with another. And I can't say there's any brilliance behind what I do. I just have a cardboard box here, one of those file boxes here in my office, and I just throw in these concepts, this little piece of science, this little piece of history, this jumbly. It's messy, I like that chaos because every now and then I got to fish through it, and this weird piece of science and this little piece of history will end up in my hand at the same time or on the floor at the same time, and all of a sudden I'll start seeing connections between the two. And nowhere in my own thought would I have connected the two except they just happened to randomly end up on the floor next to each other, which is, again...
Do you ever get the sense, James, that the story has always sort of existed, and you just kept you put it together as a puzzle? It was you just kept showing up until it revealed itself to you? Not to get too hokey here, but does that ever, because I've heard mathematicians talk about that.
It's always a possibility. It's a little frightening if that's so.
Yeah.
One of the most frightening questions I ever got asked, the question I always had the hardest time answering at a book signing is that hand that raised and goes, where do you get your ideas from? I'm afraid to even look too closely at that process because I'm afraid it's going to evaporate and go away.
Right. But that's kind of what I mean by imagination. It's one thing to say you can cross-pollinate. We know the mechanism by which you do that. However, there seems to be an initial inspiration to even get us to do things like that. There's this nostalgia for some of us, or many of us, depending, that sort of wants to do that, that somehow wants to create, like you said, writing a book. You just knew you wanted to write a book. Whether people were going to read it or not didn't matter. You had something inside you wanted to get out of you. That's what I'm fascinated by when it comes to the creative process. And in a wider scope, just the notion that is sort of seems to be very human, leaving some kind of an imprint of what we are. I guess it's a way of living forever in our own crude way.
The desire to be part of something larger.
Yeah, and leave something, leave that book on the shelf.
You want to leave something behind. You want to have your mark. You want to leave the world better than you entered it. But you probably experience a lot of that when you do improv.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much, I'm just doing improv privately in my own room.
Yeah, well, you are. Yeah, well, I mean, I think with stand-up, too, when I'm about to shoot my next special, and I kind of realized that this stuff is all sort of, it all sort of came together. It's sort of, you kind of go, wow, there's a theme to this, and I wasn't really even conscious of that, but obviously I'm writing about something that I'm sort of answering a larger question, so there it is.
But don't you think it's also that, man searches for meaning, right? And we're constantly looking for meaning, and so what happens is you have this disorganized narrative, and then you start to pick out the pieces that are going to provide the most satisfying through line.
Yeah.
So don't you think it's that we find the meaning, and that's how, and then...
I guess.
Oh, I think that's the innate human need to form patterns.
Yeah.
We're always looking for patterns as explanation. Even a lot of religion, I think, is just looking for pattern. The early theories about, where the world came from, whether the world's teetering on the back of a turtle or whether it was formed, in 7 days. We always look for patterns to explain things, and I think that... ultimately, that's a fundamental human nature, is to look for patterns in what seems to be chaos.
Well, does this? Are you a parent?
No, I'm not.
Okay. It seems like you would be interesting to see how you would raise your children, or how you would relate to children. It's interesting with your imagination and stuff. It'd be pretty wild, but that's for another time.
I'm a little frightened for how they would come out.
I was going to say, I think they'd come out just fine, my friend. It seems to me, I think the imagination makes the world go round. So thank God for people like James Rollins and books like The Eye of God, because it just makes it a lot more fun. And it's a learning experience. So when is your next book coming out, my friend?
I've got a book coming out this December. It's the second part of a sort of a vampiric series that I'm doing with another co-author. Then my next book comes out next April, and then I have a book coming out next summer.
Take it easy. Take it easy.
I've been writing while we've been talking.
Yeah, I was gonna say, dude. I'm trying to write a script. It's taken me forever. This interview has made me feel bad about myself. Hey, James Rollins, thanks so much for joining us, man. It's been a pleasure. Fascinating. And I look forward to reading more of your books.
Thanks. It's been a great deal of fun.
And congratulations again on making the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah, that's nothing for him.
Yeah,
he's an international bestseller.
Yeah. Every single time, trust me.
There's
a lot of butterflies every time a book comes out.
Yeah. I bet. It never ends, right? You just never know how your latest effort is going to pan out, right?
Exactly. You just keep hold your breath.
How do you deal with self-doubt and stuff? How do you deal with that?
A lot of exercise.
Really?
Yeah.
You work out a lot.
I work out a lot. As a matter of fact, I just finished doing Tough Mudder this past weekend.
Oh, wow.
Which was a great deal of fun. It sounds harder than it is.
Well, John Irving was actually, believe it or not, my wrestling coach for a year His son, Colin Irving, was on my wrestling team in high school, and he would come and show up. But if you read John Irving's books, he's always going out for a jog or going wrestling, you know? And I think he does that in real life. He was a great wrestler when he was younger. So, yeah, you know, I think the routine for a writer, routine and discipline for a writer is
Well, you
is
live
huge.
In your head all the time when you write, and so I think sometimes it's good just to get out there and remember that you have another part of your body besides this big brain that's in your head.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So you prescribe exercise for self-doubt and just otherwise just keep doing it.
Great stress reliever. That to me is, you know, just, you know, sometimes you get these focused and you get this narrow laser focus, and that's the source, I think, of a lot of stress is that you can't let this concept go, this worry or whatever. And sometimes if you just, you know, physically get out there and exert yourself and you get to that survival mode kicks in when you're, you know, on that last mile of some big hike.
Well, I mean, is it when you're writing a book, you've got to solve all these problems. You've got to get your characters out of these situations. Does that cause a lot of stress for you?
No, that's actually the fun part.
Huh.
Is that okay. I love painting my characters into corners.
Wow.
A lot of times my production will slow to try because I can't figure out how to get them out of that corner.
Right.
But I know that if I can't figure out how to get them out of that corner, none of my readers are going to either.
Right.
That's a pretty good jam.
And yeah.
So then, you know, then I will struggle to try to figure out how to get them out of that jam. But that's almost like, that's problem solving. That's, you know, it's a lot of fun. It's almost like a scientific method to try to figure out how to get them out of that mess.
Yeah, I was going to say. Well, that sounds like a good job, man, if you can get it.
Being a vet as a hobby.
Yeah, all you have to do, guys, if you want to be like James Rollins, just become a really successful vet, then decide to write. Then decide to write. And by the way, write 2 books a year. Maybe 3. Who knows? Maybe 3. Could be a vampiric series. Never heard that word used. Or a fantasy novel or a suspense thriller. Either way, you'll read them. Everybody reads them. And he'll add to his money pit.
And then make a few extra names for yourself just so that, you know, you can really diversify. Yeah. James Rollins.
James Rollins,
Clemens.
You make me sick, for God's sake.
Schizophrenia kicks in.
Speaking of, not a Rollins, but a Rawlings, I mean, I have you heard about J.K. Rowling's writing that, I guess, a crime thriller as another person, and I guess it got amazing reviews? Must be very satisfying for
her. I read about that, of course, and I'm just glad I'm not releasing this week right now.
Yeah, it's just like movies, baby. Yeah. Well, listen, man, best of luck. Thank you so much. For joining us. We really appreciate it. And by the way, guys, we're putting the book up on the website, briancallen.com, and go click on the Amazon banner, order the book, either download it through Audible or order it through Amazon, and write me a review of the book. And if we like it, I've gotten some great feedback. We've been getting great emails and great feedback. Write a review of the book and we'll read it on air if we like it. So there it is. James Rollins, you're a good man. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right, man.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Good guy.
Thank you very much. Sure
stuff.
Is. Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun. I had a good time. Anyway, here we are once again, Mots. Oh, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be at the Brea Improv tonight, tomorrow, the next day, and Sunday. Come down. I'm bringing heat. And then I'll be at the Schaumburg Improv. The Schaumburg Improv, ladies and gentlemen. The Schaumburg Improv in Chicago, Illinois, right outside of Chicago, Illinois, July 25th, 26th, 27th, 28th. And I just want to plug Hunter's book, The Straight A Conspiracy, which is such a good book and such must reading. It's really about the fact that you can learn anything. It's a question of what your emotional space is when you approach said learning, and Hunter believes that the worst idea ever invented is the notion that people are born smart, born with an inherent innate ability that only serves to hinder you. So believe in yourself, and if you have a nagging to do something, just start doing it, man. Just start. It doesn't matter. Do it. God, I'm so inspirational. I'm like the Tony Robbins of the Brian Callen
Show.
And
that's the amazing thing is that you don't even need to have a CD in order to launch on this journey.
It's
you just
amazing.
Need to listen to Brian's voice.
It's amazing how I bring it full circle, isn't it? This podcast would be shit without you, Motz. I want to just give Hunter Motz credit once again because he's the one who books these guests and finds these guests. He's like, dude, what do you think of this guy? I'm like, fucking great. Sounds good to me. I shouldn't use the F word so much. Apparently, I think as we get sponsored and I make millions, you will too, Hunter.
You get a money pit like
yeah,
Rollins.
You know all the
yeah.
money we're making
yeah,
off this
that's
podcast.
Right. That's right.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. I got to go work out. Whatever. I'm going to go run a Tough Mudder.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.